The first case on the court's oral argument docket today is James Parsons et al. Versus Colts Manufacturing Company, LLC, case number 81034. Counsel, as you can see, in Carson City, Associate Chief Justice Perry Gary and Justice Kadish have joined me on the bench here. In Las Vegas, Justices Silver, Herndon, and Pickering are in that courtroom. And Justice Stiglitz, although we can't see her, is participating and is viewing these proceedings and will be, no doubt, asking questions. We just are unable to connect the feed that allows her to show up live on the screen. That said, this case has been set for extended argument, 40 minutes aside, 30 minutes for each of the parties, and 10 minutes for each of the amici. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, then you may proceed, Mr. Friedman.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Rick Friedman. I'm here on behalf of Jim and Anne Marie Parsons, as well as their daughter, Carrie Parsons. We're here because the gun companies are asking this court to change Nevada law so that it provides immunity for those who illegally sell guns in violation of state and federal statutes. Although the federal district court certified three questions, in essence, you're being asked to decide two issues. The first is whether NRS section 41.131 creates civil immunity for illegal gun sales. And the second, it has to do with negligence per se. When there is a wrongful death claim premised on the illegal sale of guns in violation of state and federal statutes, do the ordinary standards of negligence per se apply, or do the sui generis alcohol negligence per se standards apply? Both of these issues are straightforward and not nearly as complicated as the briefing might suggest. So let me turn first to the claim that section 41.131 provides immunity to the illegal sellers of guns. This court has repeatedly said that if the meaning of a statute is clear and unambiguous, the court gives effect to the ordinary meaning of the plain language without turning to other rules of construction. So if you have, or if you later have, the statute in front of you, what you will immediately notice in reading the statute is that it does not try to define what sort of cases may be brought. Instead, it defines what sort of cases may not be brought. So what sort of cases may not be brought because of this statute? Cases where there is no allegation of fault, where the plaintiff is suing, quote, merely because the firearm or ammunition was capable of causing serious injury, damage, or death. The gun company's whole argument as to this statute depends on the court ignoring the words merely and because. If you go to dictionary definitions, you're going to see that merely is defined as, quote, nothing more than, or, quote, only. So if this court in the Pearden case, as we cited in our brief, also has interpreted the term merely to mean, to be synonymous with alone, simply, or solely. So if you look at this statute and you substitute, let's say, the word only or the words nothing more than, then it reads, no person has a cause of action against the manufacturer or distributor of any firearm or ammunition only because the firearm or ammunition was capable of causing serious injury, etc. Or no person has a cause of action against the manufacturer because, I'm sorry, no person has a cause of action against the manufacturer solely because the firearm or ammunition was capable of causing serious injury or death. So you have to take the entire, you have to take the word merely out of that statute, but even that is not enough to get the gun companies where they need to go. Because there's still the word because there. So the statute would read, no person has a cause of action, et cetera, because the firearm or ammunition was capable. Once again, the focus is on they're singling out a particular type or a particular type of claim, the type of claim which is based solely upon the dangerousness of a gun and not because of any wrongdoing on the part of the defendant. So you actually have to read two words out of the statute to get the gun companies where they want to go, but even that doesn't get them where they need to go, because then you have to contend with the last sentence of the statute of the first section. This subsection is declaratory and not in derogation of common law. This court's repeatedly said that a declaratory statute or one not in derogation of the common law is basically a statute that's trying to clarify the existing state of the law or restate the law as it already exists at common law. So I would suggest to the court that a good question for the gun companies is, before this statute was passed, could a gun dealer be sued for negligently shooting a customer in his store while demonstrating the gun? Again, gun dealers in his store, someone's there, he's demonstrating the gun, and he negligently shoots the customer. Under the gun company's view of this statute, the injured customer would have no right to sue.
But let me ask you a question. This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas. This statute was passed in 1985, and it hasn't been amended since. Would you agree that in 1985, a gun manufacturer who sold an AR-15 to a customer would or would not have immunity under this? Because in 1985, the sale of machine guns, as I understand it, was not outlawed. So even crediting that this applies to, that this immunity doesn't reach the sale of illegal guns or the manufacture of illegal guns, in 1985, they were legal, correct?
Well, I mean, the question of legality is somewhat confusing, but my understanding, Your Honor, is that even in 1985, it would have been illegal for an ordinary gun shop to sell a machine gun to an ordinary customer walking into the store.
What about an AR-15?
Well, what your question is getting us to, Your Honor, is the question of whether or not an AR-15 is a machine gun, which is not a question that's before this court. I think that's a really important point, because the gun companies want to argue various factual issues before this court, such as whether an AR-15 is a machine gun. But for purposes of the questions that have been certified to this court, you have to assume that they are machine guns. And so, yes, sorry.
Sorry.
This is Justice Silver. I have a question. It appears when you look at the statute and its exception, I want to ask you, how do you differentiate? This is a murder of this woman, the plaintiff here. It's a murder at the end of the day. She was murdered. Whether it's one person, 58 people, she was murdered. Doesn't it appear that the exception to immunity has more to do with the product defect, i.e., if somebody's out on a range and the AR blows up in their face, maybe the gun manufacturer may not be immune. But how do you differentiate a murder in this case? Because at the end of the day, that's what this is.
Well, I guess I would answer it this way. I don't think, first of all, that this is an immunity statute. It creates a narrow type of immunity. That's why I started off saying this statute is directed at what you cannot do, not what you can do primarily. So yes, it takes pains to say we're not trying to affect a product liability type claim, but it also is saying you cannot, but the thrust of the statute is you cannot make a claim based merely upon the fact that the gun is dangerous. And the historical reason for that is that you may be aware that in many states, products liability has one way you can prove a product is defective is by the risk-benefit analysis, is the utility of the product outweighed by its dangerousness. And historically, there have been what they call Turley suits, where people have tried to say the gun is unreasonably dangerous under that risk-benefit analysis. And so what this statute is designed to do is to say, no, we're not going to allow those Turley suits in Nevada. But there is no indication that this was intended to provide, and again, if we go to the plain meaning of the statute, what it's targeted at is that a Turley-type suit where someone is saying the risk-benefit makes this product defective, we're not going to allow those cases. It doesn't seek to prevent. It would be easy enough, and the statute could have been written to say no lawsuits may be filed against gun manufacturers for the criminal use of their guns. And some states, such as Indiana, have statutes like that. But that is not the statute as written. The plain language, again, really, there's a reason merely because is there. And again, unless you take merely because out of the statute, I don't think it matters whether it's a murder, an accidental claim. The gun company's position is any case you can imagine, that this is designed to be a, you know, again, what they're essentially, well, not essentially, what they are actually arguing is that this statute provides immunity from any kind of gun injury you can think of, except for a product, you know, a manufacturing or design defect. So again, it would prevent somebody from suing the gun dealer who accidentally discharges his weapon while demonstrating the gun. It would prevent suit from a gun company that illegally sells a gun to a 15-year-old boy who says he wants the gun to go to his school so he can shoot it up. And that's what troubled Judge Gordon when he certified these questions, is the gun companies make no bones about it. This is, and what they are asking this court for is something really quite extraordinary, that absent a legislative intent to immunize the dealer who accidentally shoots, the dealer who knowingly sells to a 15-year-old boy who states an intention to go shoot up the school, they want immunity for all of that. And I would suggest if the legislature had wanted to give that type of immunity, it would have known how to do it.
Mr. Friedman, this is Justice Hardesty.
Yes. Yes.
I wonder if we entertained this question improvidently. You point out that the determination of whether the AR-15 is a machine gun or not has not been decided by the federal district court. at least as far as I know, that hasn't been resolved in that action. Furthermore, as you appropriately argue, we are to assume that determination in answering this question. However, it's troublesome to me in that it may lead to a determination that is advisory in nature and not dispositive. And let me expand that question to this issue that has been raised. You have focused on the merely because language in 41.131, appropriately so, and obviously it's important to get the perspectives of your opponents on that point. But there's another phrase in this statute that is connected to the question I'm asking as to whether this is premature, and that has to do with whether or not the phrase any firearm includes a illegal firearm. This matter is something that has been discussed in the California Supreme Court, the Indiana Supreme Court. It would seem that that is an important question as a threshold matter before one gets into the question about the extent of the coverage of the statute 41.131 and what it immunizes or doesn't. Could you comment on that? I'm sorry for the length of the question, but it seems to me that it's important for this court to evaluate in whether we should ask the federal district court to decide the factual question first.
Well, it is an interesting question, Your Honor, and I think you have hit upon what may be the single issue that I agree with my opponents on, because when we were down arguing before Judge Gordon, the defendants argued vociferously that this statute was intended to prevent them from having to engage in factual litigation, so to speak. I'm not finding the right words, but basically they were saying this is an immunity statute. It means we never have to defend in court. We are entitled to a very quick dismissal because this provides blanket immunity. And that's, I believe, why Judge Gordon said, well, then we need to find out if this statute provides blanket immunity to things like illegal guns, because why go through literally years of discovery and probably a trial to determine that fact issue, only to find out, oh, there's immunity for the gun companies, they shouldn't have ever had to defend. So that's, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically the argument that the gun companies made below, and frankly, from our perspective as well. The reason a question is certified to this court is hopefully to provide for judicial efficiency. And so really, you're presented with a pretty clear-cut statutory construction question of whether this was intended to provide blanket immunity of the type that the gun manufacturers are claiming. If it doesn't provide that sort of immunity, then we do go to the factual question. So, for example, Justice Pickering asked questions about the legality or illegality of the AK-47 or the AR-15. Those questions are factual questions that, or mixed questions of fact and law that likely would require a trial to resolve. So that's where we are. I hope that answered your question.
Well, it does in part, but for purposes of this discussion and on this NRAP 5 question, what's your view? Does the phrase any firearm in the statute encompass illegal firearms?
Yes, I think it does. I think it does. So the sale of an illegal firearm standing alone. I guess maybe I'm not understanding what you called the NRAP 5 question. The the statute was designed to prevent a certain type of case, and it. So I guess it would apply.
Let me rephrase. Okay. So we're on the same page, and there.
Sure.
Hopefully, I'm not asking an unclear question, although that occurs from time to time. So if you aren't clear what I'm asking, let me know.
Yep.
But
okay.
When I refer to NRAP 5, this matter comes before us under Rule 5 of the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure, in which the Federal District Court certified the question that you have been discussing, whether NRS 41-131 immunizes gun companies from wrongful death claim premised on a violation of federal or state statutes prohibiting the manufacture or sale of machine guns. As part of that discussion, you were discussing the interpretation of 41-131, and you appropriately directed this court's attention to the merely because language. But before that, we're talking about whether the phrase any firearm includes or excludes illegal firearms. If it includes illegal firearms, then I guess for purposes of our answering this question, it doesn't matter whether the AR-15 is illegal or whether it's legal. And that's why I'm posing this question, because if it is a material question, something that needs to be addressed, then perhaps our entertaining this question at this time is premature.
Do
you understand my question?
I do, and I don't think it does matter whether it's legal or illegal, because what the defendants are claiming is just what I'm saying, that it doesn't matter whether it's illegal or legal. They are taking the position, and they can speak for themselves, but they're taking the position that even assuming this was an illegal firearm sale, this statute protects them from any liability as a result.
Okay. Mr. I have a question to follow up with that then. Say under the statute, I'm looking at it right now, you take what you just said, that your position is it doesn't encompass illegal. But what if there's a rifle and somebody takes a saw to it and cuts off the barrel? Now it's a short gun, a short barreled. Doesn't this statute immunize manufacturers if somebody goes and saws off the barrel? Or are they liable under this statute?
No, what we're concerned with and what Judge Gordon was concerned with was an illegal sale of firearms and whether that's immunized. And so that's the way the issues have been presented to this court. So there are lots of gun issues, like if you cut off a shotgun, but the sale of a shotgun that is then cut off, that does raise the question, and that might be a factual defense for the manufacturers on our argument that the AR-15 is easily modifiable. So for sure, that's a factual argument they may want to make. But in terms of what's before this court, as the Chief Justice was saying, what's before this court is whether this statute provides immunity basically no matter what, which no matter what wrongful conduct a manufacturer engages in, under the gun company's view, they're immunized by this statute. And let me say it again, no matter what wrongful conduct they engage in, they are immunized by this statute.
Well, just to get a clarification, that pivots on any. That seems to be the pivotal issue here is what does any mean? Because that whether it's illegal or legal, any firearm.
Merely because the firearm was capable of causing serious injury. Again, the purpose of this statute was to stop these Turley suits where somebody was saying the risk of this weapon outweighs its benefits and therefore it's defective. That was the whole purpose of the statute. That's the plain language of the statute. That's the legislative history of the statute. So the a statute that was designed to say we're not going to allow a risk-benefit analysis to be run in Nevada to argue that this product is defective. This product, meaning a legal or illegal firearm, is defective. We're not going to allow that case to proceed no matter what, is being read by the manufacturers and the dealers to say, oh, it does more than just protect against the risk-benefit analysis. It also protects against anything bad we do related to guns.
But let me interrupt you, sir. This is Justice Pickering, and I'm not sure, and it may be the problem with the certified questions. If you, as I understand your argument, I think there's a difference between a gun store that has someone come in, the 15-year-old you described, and says, I need a gun to go shoot up the school, and they sell it to them. That, to me, would be beyond this statute, just thinking out loud, because there's more than merely because the gun was sold. There was a declaration and probably some facilitation in that setting. But as I understood your argument, what you were saying is that AR-15 equals machine gun. Machine gun is illegal for a manufacturer to manufacture or a gun dealer to sell unless it's to an officer of the police or whatever the federal exceptions are on that. And so you are saying that just the sale, let's leave to one side the advertising of these as readily convertible. You're saying just the sale of an AR-15 is itself actionable under this statute, or am I mistaking that? And that's you're saying that's because the sale is forbidden.
Well, it's not. We're not saying it's actionable under this statute. We're saying it's actionable under both the Nevada and federal statutes that prohibit the sale of machine guns.
Let me clarify then. Say, despite the immunity afforded by this statute.
That's right. And so those cases. What we're saying is this is a narrow statute designed to only prevent a certain type of case. But in direct response to your question, yes, down at the trial court level, it is our claim that this AR-15 is a machine gun under the definitions that apply. That's a factual question that is not before this court. The question before this court is, assuming it is a machine gun, or assuming any other type of wrongful conduct, does this statute immunize manufacturers from wrongful conduct?
Well, but is there any other alleged wrongful conduct beyond the sale of what you contend is an illegal firearm?
No, that is the wrongful conduct. So that's why I was using the analogy of selling to a 15-year-old boy. Come up with whatever hypothetical you want. The wrongful conduct is selling an illegal weapon. But the gun company's position is this statute immunizes them from all wrongful conduct. That's the question before the court. Does this immunize them from all wrongful conduct or doesn't it? If it does, then no one needs to look into whether the AR-15 is illegal or not. If this statute doesn't provide immunity for all wrongful conduct, then there is going to have to be a factual inquiry before another court about whether the AR-15 is a machine gun or not. We did not brief that issue. It's not before the court. And so what Judge Gordon needed assistance on was the argument the gun companies were making that they shouldn't even have to defend. This case should go no further. They were entitled to dismissal at the very front end because regardless of the facts, they were entitled to complete immunity. That's why it's in front of you now, because of that argument that they made. If I could, I see I only have less than 2 minutes left. So let me just make the key point on negligence per se, which is the gun companies are asking you to take two cases, really, three arguably, dealing with alcohol and saying those cases change the negligence per se law as to everything in Nevada. The problem with that argument is in no other context than alcohol has this court ever said that there must be a legislative intent expressed before negligence per se is applied. Never. And in those two cases, Ham and Heinbecker, something like that. In those two cases, the court didn't overrule all the prior negligence per se cases, which did not require legislative intent. And in all the cases since then, since Heinbecker, in all of those cases since, this court has never said there's a requirement of legislative intent. It's only in the alcohol context where, because of the peculiar nature of those statutes, and you can read that in the cases, because of the peculiar nature of the alcohol statutes and the peculiar history of those statutes, the court said, in this context, in this, so basically, Nevada's always followed the restatement in this, on the negligence per se issue, and we would ask you to continue to adhere to that, except in the alcohol context. Thank you.
Ms. Shanks?
Chief, this is Justice Herndon. I had a question for Mr. Friedman, but I didn't want to interrupt him during his, when he was talking for 2 minutes about the negligence per se, but may I be allowed to ask it?
Yes, of course.
Mr. Friedman, earlier in your, or on a couple of occasions in your argument, you referenced whether the legislature created immunity. And I think what this court's focus has been on in the past with regard to negligence per se is whether the legislature has created a right of action, not whether they've not created a right of action or created some type of immunity by a statute. In regard to the statute at issue here in Chapter 41, later in that chapter, there are a number of statutes creating rights of action in regard to penal statute violations. Chapter 200 prohibits use of children in production of pornography. 41.1396 creates a right of action for people who have been victimized by that. Chapter 200 creates a criminal statute for abuse of elderly or vulnerable people. 41.1395 creates a right of action for people who are victimized by that. There's similar statutes related to human trafficking, related to even a misdemeanor statute, disseminating information about the victim of a sex offense. 41.1398 creates a right of action for that. So clearly, where the legislature wants to, they could step in, whether it's legal or illegal firearms, and create a right of action, but they haven't done so here. So aren't we kind of being asked as a court to improperly legislate this issue versus allowing the legislature to do their job, if they want to create something along those lines?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you look at your negligence per se cases, and I would draw a distinction between creating a cause of action and applying negligence per se. A cause of action is what gets you into court. So, for example, we're in court here on a wrongful death statute, which gives us a right to relief. Causes of action give someone a right to relief. So, for example, if in the common law there was no right to be not to be discriminated against in housing. So if I'm a Buddhist and I go to try to rent a house and somebody says you can't because you're a Buddhist, I've got no claim at common law, no right to a remedy. Under if the legislature creates a cause of action for discriminatory housing, they can then say, yes, you've got this cause of action. Negligence per se deals with how you prove your claim. So is there, in your cases over and over again, and I point you most, the most prominent and easy to understand is the Ross case, Ross versus Carson Construction, where somebody drove into a big ditch on a construction site, and the court said we don't have to determine whether what the common law status of this person is. This statute, absent any legislative intent to say so, says this creates a duty, and this creates a standard of care. So in the, you could go through, and frankly, I didn't anticipate your question, so I haven't done this, but I think you can go through, well, I think you could go through your negligence per se cases, and you would see, you could make the same argument that your question implied out of the Ross statutes. I'm sure there are some sections of various codes that create causes of action, but we are not asking the court to create a cause of action. We're asking you to apply your ordinary negligence per se jurisprudence to this category of statutes. That's different than creating a cause of action. I hope that addressed your question.
No, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Yes, you're welcome. Ms. Shanks, you're ready to proceed.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, Therese Shanks here on behalf of the Nevada Justice Association as amicus in support of the Mr. Friedman's clients. I would like to start with the question of whether the court should even reach the issue in making its determination as to whether NRS 41.131 covers illegal firearms. The answer to that question lies in both the legislative history and in the sister statutes enacted around the country. When the Turley lawsuits were filed in the early 1980s, a national debate over gun control began. The McClure-Volkmer Act was already before United States Congress. Many states were being seeing rises in this theory that you could sue a gun manufacturer for strict liability merely because they made a gun, not because there was something wrong in the way they made the gun, but simply because they made a gun and guns are dangerous. And strict liability has previously been reserved for abnormally dangerous activities. These are the dynamite cases from law school, the case with the man who built a dam on his land that flooded. And so states and legislatures across the country enacted similar statutes to NRS 41.131. If this court would like, amicus would be happy to provide a list of those statutes. But some notable ones are Arkansas statute, for example. Arkansas Code Section 16-116-302, subpart D, subpart 1. States, notwithstanding their statute, which has almost identical language to NRS 41.131, a firearms manufacturer can be sued in tort for any damages proximately caused by the act of the manufacturer in violation of a state law or rule. Oklahoma's statute uses the word lawfully. So if they lawfully sold the firearm, they cannot be sued for that, and that would end a basic canons of statutory instruction seem to exclude unlawful sale or manufacture. The statute that NJA focused on the most was California's statute, because our legislative history states that that is the statute that the bill drafters modeled NRS 41.131 after. NRS 41.131 wound up becoming a much more narrower drafted statute than its predecessor in California. But what NJA found most notable about the California statute is that when it was interpreted by the California Supreme Court to apply the immunity that this court is being asked to apply here by the respondents, the California legislature immediately repealed it. It immediately repealed it because that type of immunity is not what the California legislature intended. It wasn't what was intended by the Turley lawsuits. Turley lawsuits, again, were focused solely on, you sold me a gun, and any gun is dangerous, therefore you should be strictly liable for harm that comes from it. And that, in my understanding, that's not what's being argued here, but what the certified question is asking is, to what extent does this immunity extend? And would it encompass claims where the person is not contending that a gun in and of itself is simply unreasonably dangerous, but where they are contending that there is some wrongful conduct associated with the manufacture or distribution of the gun, in addition to the dangerous nature of the gun itself? And when the California Supreme Court interpreted their sister statute as allowing that immunity to exceed a negligence claim, the California legislature said no, and they repealed it. And I believe we believe that the same effect should be had here. If you read NRS 41.131, it does state nearly as was previously argued by my colleague. Another interesting section is that it states it's not in derogation of common law. And if you review the legislative history, you see there is substantial discussion as to whether this statute is needed, because strict products liability common law would tend to preclude Turley lawsuits. But because the Turley lawsuits were being filed and because they were getting traction, legislatures across the country enacted statutory protection for manufacturers that products like guns, and by any extension, any product that could be used in a harmful manner, would not fall within the common law doctrines of liability. They did not want to create that precedent, so they codified common law. Another question that was asked is that the AR-15 would not have been sold illegally. And I just would like to point out that when I reviewed the certified questions, I had to look at the pleadings to understand the context in which they were coming from. My understanding of what the district court for the United States District of Nevada is grappling with is whether when someone comes to you and says, not that you sold me an illegal gun or that you used a gun and guns are dangerous, but that what you did in manufacturing this gun violated a state statute. In other words, I believe the allegations are that the manner in which the platform of gun that was created and used in this case could be easily modified with a bump start cartridge, and a bump start cartridge would turn it into an illegal automatic gun, and that the wealth of knowledge that's out there based upon that demonstrates that perhaps these manufacturers should have altered their design, knowing that they were basically creating a weapon that could be very easily modified into and compatible with bump start cartridges. And as Amiki points out, there's lots of legislation across this country, legislation that began going to effect after Sandy Hook, that outlaws bump start cartridges because they do make otherwise legal guns into illegal machine guns. But again, as my colleague pointed out, that's still a question that I didn't see in the certified questions, but I do think that the legality is an important issue. And I think that that's a question of law and statutory interpretation that this court can draw upon with its statutory interpretation canons to answer. Does this court have any questions?
I don't believe so, Ms. Shanks. Thank you for, Justice Kadish has a question.
Sorry, Ms. Shanks, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. So reading the NRS 41.131 statute, and I guess focus then on the merely because language, which you and Mr. Friedman focused on, what is it? How do you understand the pleadings in this case and the claim asserted to be based on something beyond what is precluded here by the merely because language? What about the claims asserted here takes it outside this statute?
My understanding is that the claims in this case are saying you created a gun that you've known is very easily modifiable, and other manufacturers have managed to get rid of that modification, but you didn't. And therefore, you know, you should have done that. And when you didn't do that, you were in violation of federal law. I don't know if, I don't know if that will be meritorious under federal law, but that's my understanding, which is very different than simply saying you made a gun that someone used to kill somebody. It goes beyond that to saying, you know, you have the foreseeability, you have the knowledge that these could be modified, and that was just not changed.
And if even if we agreed that this statute did not preclude this claim, there would still have to be a showing of proximate cause, would there not?
I believe so. I believe that the way I read the certification order, the district court was asking this court for clarification as to whether this statute should be applied to effectively end the case or whether it falls outside of the statute. And then if it does, I believe that all those additional factual issues which have been identified still have to proceed. I'm not involved with that district court case, so I don't know the status of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Shanks? All right, seeing none, thank you, Ms. Shanks. We'll proceed then to Mr. Hemanowski. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Hemanowski?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. Thank you for the opportunity. Let me start with something really basic because I think it's important to understand a simple legal factor regarding the AR-15. These rifles hit the civilian market in 1963. The statutes, what we call the machine gun statutes that were to make machine guns illegal, came into effect in May of 1986 at the federal level and in 1989 at the state level. What that meant was that machine guns are legal to possess if they were manufactured prior to May of 1986, and they were restricted after that date. So our statute, 202.350B1, I believe it is, which restricts the use of machine guns, does not, contrary to what my colleague's brief says, ban all machine guns. It put in place restrictions on the future manufacture of machine guns. So when we talk about what's legal and not legal, we have to do it in the context of understanding that AR-15s have a history as a legal firearm that greatly predates the statutes. When we turn to the immunity of 41.131, that was not enacted until 1983, I believe it was, and it came in an interesting context. Because it was preceded by the constitutional amendment in 1982 and 1983, excuse my dates, and in that constitutional amendment, the Secretary of State had told the voters, if you approve this amendment, future legislatures will not be able to pass restrictive gun control laws. The voters approved the amendment two and a half times to one. Then in the next legislature, we turn to 41.131. My colleagues would suggest to you that this statute is patterned on the California statute. It absolutely, unequivocally is not. That's a misnomer. If you look at the legislative history, you'll see that the initial bill draft was patterned on a California bill, but even Mr. Dakin, the legislative counsel, said that was a really poorly drawn statute. And the sponsor of the legislation, Senator Robinson, said, this won't do. We have to completely rewrite it. And they did. And when they rewrote it, in one of the last hearings in the assembly, the chairman of the assembly committee with Senator Robinson in the room said, what Senator Robinson wants to ensure is that if he is murdered, his heirs cannot sue the manufacturer of the gun, which, of course, is exactly what's happening here. When we turn to the statute 41.131 and look at the language that's used, look how all-inclusive it is. It starts, no person has a cause of action. There's no limitation on what's meant by person. There's no limitation on what's meant by cause of action. No person has a cause of action. You can't get much broader than that. It goes on to say, against a manufacturer or distributor of any firearm, and firearm includes, by definition, machine gun. And it's telling us here, when we say no claim against a manufacturer, well, what do manufacturers do? They manufacture. What do distributors do? They distribute. Here's a statute that says you cannot bring an action against them for doing that without any kind of limitation to say, as my colleagues would say, a wrongful manufacture or a wrongful sale. No. anything having to do with manufacture or distribution of firearms is the subject of this immunity. Now, that, please understand, that does not mean somebody who does wrong gets a pass, because our legislature has declared that the enforcement arm that's going to be used for firearm regulation will be the criminal statutes. We use law enforcement to enforce these things. And if somebody has done wrong, they may not be subject to civil liability, but they will certainly face draconian penalties in the criminal case. In the federal system, it'll be up to 10 years. In the state system, up to 5 years in prison, loss of licenses and everything else that goes with it. So this is not a blanket immunity. It's an immunity against the harassment of civil lawsuits, and only that. And when we talk about statute, and there's some discussion about it being declaratory and not in derogation of the common law, let's go back and put that in context. If I use Ham as an example, it was pointing out that under the common law, a vendor of a product was not liable for a subsequent misuse of the product by a criminal. That was the state of the common law. At the time of Ham in 1969, it was a state of the common law when 41.131 was passed. And what the legislature said, in effect, with that last clause is, we declare this is the common law. We're fixing it by statute so it won't be modified by courts. And we're telling you this is not in derogation of the common law. We're not reducing the coverage of the common law. We are enshrining it in statute. Now, there was discussion about the significance of merely because. And the merely because language is telling us that the fact that the weapon or firearm functions as it's intended to function is not going to create a cause of action. And what are we here for today? We're here today because the subject rifles fired ammunition into a music festival and caused injury. That's why we're here. This is the bottom of their claim, is the discharge of the firearms. Compare that to the second section, of course, where the court carves out and says this does not affect a product liability claim for a mismanufactured weapon, something that has flaws, bad metallurgy, and it blows up when you use it. That claim is preserved. Only that claim. When the legislature speaks and says we're only carving out this exception, it's not for us to go out and create another one under a statute that has this broad immunity. And when I talk about that immunity, please remember that if you take a look at Chapter 41, there are at least 13 other instances I saw in 41 where the legislature has declared different degrees of civil immunity from lawsuits. This is not unique. We have other areas where the legislature has said, as a matter of public policy, we will have civil immunity. To follow up on a question that Justice Herndon had raised about the creation of a private cause of action, that was in the negligence per se context, because as you know, to have negligence per se, you must have both a duty of care and a standard of care. And the duty of care either comes out of the common law or it comes out of legislative intent. And he was asking, where's the legislative intent to create a cause of action here? I suggest you take a look at NRS 268.418, 2015 statute. And in that statute, the legislature declared flatly the regulation of firearms, including their manufacture and including specifically machine guns, and believe it or not, even including bump stocks. They said this is all in the exclusive domain of the legislature and no one else should mess with it, in effect. And then they went a step further. And I believe it's subsection 9 where they created a private cause of action. They actually said any person, in this case it would be gun owner, who is aggrieved by a violation of 268.418 has a private cause of action in which they can pursue actual damages, double and treble damages, attorney's fees, injunction, a very detailed analysis of a private cause of action created in the context of firearms. The legislature knows how to do it. They did it, but they didn't do it in this case. And what's significant about that is they didn't do it time and time again, because firearms have been in front of the legislature many times. And the most important time, which has been ignored by my colleagues, is in 2019. Imagine that, 2019, 2 years after the events at the music festival. There is a hearing brought before the assembly by an assemblywoman who was at the festival, who testified movingly to the trauma that she went through. And she brought forward legislation to be considered by the legislature. And they conducted hearings. They heard from a number of different interested areas. They heard from law enforcement. They heard from victims. They heard from gun advocate controls. They heard from gun owners. They heard from all those groups. They're not here today. But the legislature was equipped to handle those. And they heard all that. And then what did they do? Did they amend 41-131? No. Did they amend the machine gun statute? No. What they did is they outlawed bump stocks. But despite all that testimony about the role played by the AR-15, they took no action with respect to the subject rifles. They left the law as it was. If the legislature had wanted to change policy, they had that opportunity several different times. One of the things that's, I part company from my learned colleague on, is the Ham case. I want to use that as an example, because Ham said, basically, common law is, vendor is not liable for the misuse of the product by a downstream criminal. This was the common law. And Ham said, if there's to be a change in that longstanding policy, it's the legislature who should make that change. Among other reasons, because the legislature is so much better equipped than the courts to conduct the kind of investigation into these policy questions. The legislature had the opportunity to hear from all those people I described in 2019. We don't have them here today because in a court proceeding, we only have the positions being advocated of the two parties. We don't have all the others who might be interested. Examples of, you know, if there's to be a change in policy, don't we want to hear from the people who own sporting goods stores? We want to hear from the people who are conducting hunting tours? Do we want to hear from backpackers? Do we want to hear from ranchers? Do we need to hear from farmers? All of these potential interested groups fall within the exclusive domain of legislative enactment.
Mr. Hymanowski, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Hopefully you'll find me in the right box on your screen there. So if you have a manufacturer who knowingly manufactures an illegal weapon of some kind, or, you know, a dealer who, as a hypothetical earlier today was mentioned, you know, knowingly sells to a 15-year-old who wants to go shoot up their school, you're saying that even with the merely because language in the statute, it would still be barred by 41-131. Is that right?
41-131 would bar a civil action. But prison looms large.
Right.
That's the enforcement mechanism the legislature chose. And it's really not our purview to change that.
So why is the merely because language there? Why didn't they just say, you know, no liability for anything that happens with a gun? You know, why did they use those specific terms then?
This really, I believe, comes out of the legislative history. In one of the earlier discussions about the statute, when they were having their first hearing on it, there was discussion principally brought by Mr. Dakin, who was then the Legislative Counsel Bureau, trying to explain what they were trying to do. And he started out saying he wanted to say plainly that the fact that a firearm either causes or is capable of causing death or serious injury does not make it defective in design, because after all, it's meant to cause death or serious injury when used deliberately. And that's when they got into the discussion about the California statute, and they backed away from that entirely and went to this different formulation, which starts with the idea that just because, or merely because, it produces bullets at a high, excuse me, just because, sorry, just because it shoots, it's covered by the statute. Just because it shoots, that's why we're here, because somebody got shot. And the fact that there was allegedly wrongful manufacture or allegedly wrongful distribution doesn't change that. The statute doesn't have an exception in it for fine degrees of what's being manufactured or fine degrees of what's being distributed. It's a blanket immunity for manufacturers and distributors, whether it's wrongful manufacture or not. But again, that's because the legislature has chosen the criminal justice system as the enforcement arm for this statute. And that's consistent with, very consistent with what I was trying to say about NRS 268. And there are some parallels. Actually, 268 is one of three statutes passed at the same time by the legislature. But they, in each instance, they made that same very strong statement. Exclusive domain in the legislature. And it specifically applies to the manufacture of firearms. And firearms specifically and expressly includes machine guns. And expressly includes bump stocks. And then they created a draconian private cause of action. The legislature has been very much involved in firearms for a very long time. And they have staked out an area where they have tried to use their expertise to set up the state policy. And if there were any question about that state policy, why? Why in 2019 did it remain unchanged? Why didn't the legislature take action? We've been many times in the past, this court has said, when the legislature has not taken action, we can infer from that that they meant to leave it be. And that's really what happened here. I'd like to digress for just a moment, because I don't want to forget this point. My learned colleague suggested that the principles articulated in Ham are restricted to alcohol cases and have not, by this court, been applied anywhere else. That is flat wrong. And I'll give you as an example, how about the Sanchez case, which was decided in 2009, which was a negligence per se case. And the court went through that history looking for the duty of care and couldn't find it. And it's interesting that along the way, the court cited as legislative history the comment in the legislature where someone said the legislature is not responsible for people's personal decision, and ultimately it's the board's duty to prosecute violations. What they were saying, of course, was the same thing, that we don't have a common law duty on the part of vendors, in that case pharmacists, to guard against the misuse of the product by somebody downstream. It's a personal decision. And furthermore, that we're going to look to the legislative enforcement, which was the board at that time. In our case, of course, it's the criminal justice system. You could also consider the Richardson case, which was another decision that came out, if I could only find my copy of it. I guess I'm not going to find it real quick. Richardson case likewise said that if we're going to do anything here, we're going to take a look and see what the legislature has done, and from that, we can infer whether or not there's going to be a private cause of action that can be pursued. And in doing that, the court said, you know, quoting it, we have already concluded in another context that when a statute does not expressly provide for a private cause of action, the absence of such a provision suggests that the legislature did not intend for the statute to be enforced through a private cause of action. And that was a decision in 2007. In our case, of course, we have no such express intent.
Mr. Hymanowski, this is Justice Pickering. The Sanchez case really seems to say that looking at the statute in that case, they didn't find the plaintiff to be a person who harm to whom the statute was designed to prevent. So that would really not answer the negligence per se issue. And then the second point you were making about the implied private right of action, that's distinct, I think, from negligence per se, where you have to have a duty and it's breach. But on a pure negligence per se, as I understand it, the statute is just setting the standard of conduct. It is a different concept than an implied private right of action. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Negligence per se, and I think you and I are saying the same thing, requires two elements. You need a duty of care, which can be provided either by the common law or by the statute that's involved. And you need a standard of care, which is always provided by the statute. In the case of Sanchez, when they looked for the duty of care, they turned finally to saying, look, the pharmacies do not own a duty of care to the public at large. Indeed, a duty of care to the public at large really is a non-starter for negligence per se. Not having that, they then turned to look further at the statute to see if there was something in there that implied or created a cause of action, and they found nothing. And when you look at our statutes, you're in really the same place. NRS 202-350B1 simply provides, frankly, a means of regulating the future production of machine guns. That's what it does. It doesn't say anything about who's to be protected or not protected by it. You know, as a collateral benefit, I'm sure the public gets some benefit from that restriction on machine guns. But the statute itself is there to regulate or restrict the future production of machine guns, not the ones that already existed. There is no cause of action implicit in that statute, and that's the one on which the claim really has to be grounded. Then you turn to 41-131, and there's your legislative intent. There shall be no civil immunity.
Liability.
I'm sorry. I get a little carried away, and I apologize. But that's really the effect of it. We have a matter, when we're talking about these issues, that has really been declared to be the legislative domain. The law right now grants immunity from civil claims. If there's to be a change in these fundamental policies, it's something that should be addressed by the legislature. One, because they said it's their area, but two, and more importantly, they're much better equipped to balance all the myriad interests that have to be served in setting policies in an area like this.
Let's say, Mr. Hymanowski, that somebody disagrees with your all-or-nothing immunity approach, and they would attach liability and disallow immunity for the situation of a gun dealer who has a 15-year-old come into his shop and say, I got to go kill everybody at my school. They've been bullying me, and I've had it. And so he sells him the gun, or he sells it to a felon that he knows is a felon who is also enraged about something. It seems to me you could say that distributor did more than just, is alleged to have done more than just sell a gun that could injure somebody. So it wouldn't be liability merely because. It would give meaning to merely because. I'm not as clear on whether the, because of the any firearm language in the statute, whether that extends to the sale of, say, a sawed-off shotgun that Justice Silver was earlier alluding to, take it out of the machine gun setting. And what I'm leading up to, I want to circle back to Justice Hardesty's point that is it appropriate for us to be trying to parse between these meanings on a certified question where the district court judge has said, yeah, we got to go forward to discovery on whether AR-15s are machine guns. But how precise is it that we're analyzing this statute on this record? And I'd like your comments on that. I apologize for the long question, and it's partially inarticulate. But
no, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address it. And frankly, I hadn't really focused on the issue that Judge Hardesty raised until he brought it up, and I recognize it as a very legitimate point. Because, like a lot of certified questions, we are being asked to address a hypothetical in effect. We have a very incomplete record, as these things often come to the court. We are asked to evaluate these questions in a very artificial context because of that. I mean, the record on appeal in this case, as you know, is just 250 pages or so. It's not very enlightening. But if I circle back to the statute itself, I find support in the fact that the definition of firearms is just that, firearm. There's no restriction on rate of fire, caliber, how it's delivered, the design weapons. It's just all-inclusive. So the statute, going way back when, if the court is asked by the Judge Gordon to say, what does the statute mean? It means just what it says. It means that manufacturers and distributors acting in the role as manufacturer and distributor cannot be civilly sued even for allegedly wrongfully manufacturing. We have enough on this record to reach that question.
Right, but are you pressing the point that if the firearm store sells to a 15-year-old who's made a declaration of why he wants the firearm to shoot up the school, are you saying that that's a necessary part of your reading of that statute?
I'm always reluctant to reach up and grab hypotheticals because they have some issues that may not be helpful because we don't have a good factual background. But subject to that qualification, if somebody goes into a store to buy a firearm and says they're going to use it to commit a crime, however horrific, and somebody sells that gun, whoever sells it is going to jail. That's what the legislature has decided is going to be our enforcement mechanism. If we don't like it personally, then we need to go to the legislature and say we need to change it. But for the purposes of our proceedings, the legislature has said this is how we're going to handle it. Is there anything else I could profitably address?
Are there any other questions for Mr. Hamanowski at this time? All right, Mr. Hamanowski, thank you for your time. We'll turn over to Mr. Schwartz for his 10 minutes.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Very well.
Oh, good. Thank you. First, I want to thank you all for allowing me to. It's an honor to be before this court. I've looked up the backgrounds of you all, and it's a very impressive.
Mr. Schwartz, I don't know if you can hear me, but your communication mechanism or system is freezing up or
just
delaying
from
it.
The screen.
Are you present or not?
Chief, his call dropped. This is Justice Stiglitz.
The products.
Mr. Schwartz.
Probably more people are told by.
Mr. Schwartz, I hate to interrupt.
Yes.
I hate to interrupt you, Mr. Schwartz, but your communication system froze or something. We lost you, and we haven't heard a thing you've said since
you. Okay, can you hear me now? Production. Oh, boy. One second. You hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Hello? You can?
Yes, sir.
You can hear me now?
Yes, sir.
All right. Sorry, the technology. I was saying it was an honor to be before this court. Tort law has been my life. Some of you have used prosecuting in law school, and I thank you. I've given the royalties to charities, and I helped write the restatement of torts third. One part of tort law that hasn't changed, and most of it has, is characteristics. And the Nevada statute, the federal statute, reflects the common law that manufacturers of products that have danger, serious danger, like an automobile that goes 100 miles an hour, are not subject to liability. I mean, somebody who sells cars knows there's going to be a lot of illegal use, but they're not liable in tort law, and that is a fundamental. Sometimes there is a temptation to change tort law because of the Straight Act, but a very President Clinton called that regulation through litigation. And Mr. Hamanowski kind of adverted to this, but it is a legislative characteristics of danger. Yes.
I apologize for interrupting, but once again, we're having difficulty. Your communication
can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. All right. Is it working now?
Mm-hmm. Intermittent. I guess intermittently is the best way to describe it.
Boy, that's really... Well, let me try different distances. Does this work?
Yes, sir. So far.
This works better?
Yes, sir. So far.
Does this work better? You can hear me.
Sir, the problem you've got is your connection. It's the connection that's creating the difficulty. So unless we're able to fix that, I'm going to have to conclude your argument, and we'll rely on your brief for your comments, which, by the way, is excellent, and we appreciate that input and that perspective.
Can you call?
Okay, well, if it fixes, let me know.
So one alternative that is suggested is can you call on the phone line and communicate? That would probably circumvent the problem.
Yes, I can. Slowly give me the number. Can you give me the number?
Call.
Hold on.
Can you give the number?
I'm going to call.
Mr. Rickman?
I have my phone.
Oh, hold on a second. We're getting it.
Oh, okay.
Got too many people talking.
Area code 408.
Hold it. Go slow. 1-408.
Mm-hmm.
419.
41? Did you say 41?
419.
419.
1-7.
Yes.
1-5.
1-7-1-5. Okay. Does it work?
Find out.
We'll find out.
I would suggest muting your computer now as well.
Yes, exactly.
Pardon me? You're saying I need some kind of code.
Okay, I'm going to give that to you right now.
ID.
Okay, I'm going to give that to you right now.
What? Pardon? Okay.
525-769-769-893-893. And it'll ask you for a participant ID number, and that is 6926.
Now they're asking me for a moderator or meeting password. I guess it's a number.
6926.
6926.
Yes, sir. And that should bring you into the meeting.
I'm now being placed in the meeting. Now can you hear me?
Mr. Schwartz, can you mute your computer now?
Oh, okay. Wait 1 second. 1 minute. Okay, sir, go ahead and speak if you...
Now we can't hear him on the phone.
I'm afraid we can't hear you on the phone, sir.
No.
Can you hear me the other way?
At least he's not a cat.
Is the audio working?
He did
it's intermittent, Mr. Schwartz. It's problematic. Right. I'm sorry.
All right.
Well, and the phone didn't work. Okay. All right. I don't know why. I appreciate the efforts our staff is making and you are making, but I don't intend to perpetuate this. Without assigning any kind of fault, I just, it's one of those technological things that is problematic. But your point of view has been adequately and amply expressed in the amicus brief, and we'll have the case submitted on that basis.
Okay. Would I be permitted to file a brief supplement?
Yes, sir, no more than 10 pages.
Oh, it'll be short. I'm sure it'll be 5 pages. That's fine.
That's even better yet, but that's fine. You're allowed 10 as long as you can do that within the next 7 days, please. I'm sorry, I can't hear you, but that, of course, underscores the problem. I would like to, at this time, express my thanks and appreciation to Mr. Friedman, Ms. Shanks, Mr. Hemanowski, for your excellent arguments today and the briefing we've received, and thanks, Mr. Schwartz, for your participation as well. The case will stand submitted, subject, however, to Mr. Schwartz's supplemental submission, and we will be in recess. Thank you all for your arguments today.